Welcome to episode 211 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
I managed to get research and links without deleting anything from episode 210 today, so you can find those by visiting thelabwithbrad.com.
Congratulations.
Yeah, no disasters whatsoever.
You said this episode has something to do, or you said it's my fault.
It is. Well, bits of it are. I recommend you listeners out there that you take a listen to episode 210, because I'm not going to cover it again. We were talking about the basal ganglia, the direct and indirect motor pathways.
All those crazy tongue-twisting names.
Yes, main parts we were dealing with were the substantia nigra, the striatum, the globus pallidus, and the other bit.
all those things.
Oh, the subthalamic nucleus, that's right.
Oh, that one.
That's right. I want to make something clear, by the way. The cortex is not part of the basal ganglia, and neither is the thalamus.
Okay.
Those are other bits. But you also had some questions, and I did some research. Reflexes totally happen without the brain.
Neat. What's a brain good for?
Most of them. Well, many reflexes, like the one where the doctor hits your kneecap with that little hammer and makes your leg kick.
Yeah.
It does that. It hits this tendon. It sends a signal to your spinal cord. Mm-hmm. Synapses directly onto the nerves that activate your quadricep and cause your hamstring to relax. And your leg moves. But never in all any of that is the brain involved. However, there are... I can't remember if it's the tectum or the ventral tectum.
Okay.
But this is towards the top of your midbrain, mm-hmm. next to the superior canaliculus and inferior canaliculus.
You know,
right?
Yeah.
The superior has to do with vision, and the inferior has to do with sound.
Okay.
And those areas, together with the tectums,
sure.
They have to do with reflexes that are triggered by auditory or visual stimulus. And that's as far as I got. The only one I can think of is the blink reflex.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there are others. Well, I'm not sure. Like I said, that's as far as I got.
Well. Yeah, I can't think of anything else other than blinking.
Right. So, totally off the subject, blink. I had success and failure with some of my experiments over the past week.
Okay.
In episode 208 and 209, we were talking about an experiment I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
As you recall, you push the button, there's a light.
Yeah.
You add a delay until the subject is used to that delay, and then you take the delay away, ignore the fact that you rhymed, and it can feel to the subject like the order of events is reversed, so that even though they push the light and the light comes on because they push the light, it can feel like the light comes on before they push the button.
Weird.
Yes. So I couldn't see why Phil couldn't see what was interesting about that.
I still don't. Anyway,
it finally occurred to me that the problem was I don't want to put someone else in the box with the button. I want to be in the box with the button. The only way I'm going to plumb the bits I'm interested in is to subjectively experience itself, the effect myself. Mm-hmm. And I failed at that. I wrote a little program. And I could not evoke the illusion in myself. Part of the problem might be because I'm using sound instead of sight.
Yeah.
I'm blind. I can't see a flash of light, so I thought I'd use a beep. No joy.
No joy.
No joy. I can tell you I have had a reverse order illusion without pushing any buttons. Every time I edit this, actually, there's these little clicks and pops and so forth that I go through and I take out. And sometimes... when I first hear it, I'll think, for example, that the pop happens before a consonant.
Okay.
And then when I zoom in to get rid of the damn thing, it turns out that the pop is happening after the consonant.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I can get the reverse order illusion with sound.
What you're saying is you go crazy while you're editing.
That's exactly what I'm saying. The successful experiment. Mm. I wrote a program that solves Sudoku puzzles.
Mm.
Hooray!
I want to feed it some someday.
Yeah, but... so do I. So far, I've only tested it. Like, I put in numbers to make sure that it could tell whether or not a puzzle was valid.
Ah, okay.
Right, you know Sudoku.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a 9x9 grid.
Yes, you do.
And you got the column to deal with, the row to deal with, and a grid of 3x3 squares to deal with.
It's all... numerals
1 through 9 must be there, and no duplications in any row, column, or cell.
Mm-hmm.
So, I set it up so that all but one square were filled in a cell, 3x3 grid. The last number would be a 9, and then I put a 9 in the same row, but outside of that cell.
Ah.
So, the program can't tell that it's not good when it first loads it, but when it tries to solve it, it goes, no. Cannot be done.
What is this garbage you're feeding me?
But yeah, I got that to work. Probably go back and I want to add some documentation in case I ever want to play with it again. There's a couple things to try. I'm tempted to see if I can use the same algorithm to do the game 2048.
Yes,
it's a difference.
You're adding movement.
You're adding movement and a random factor. Sudoku is static. Once you've got that first set of numbers and you start filling in squares, nothing changes. It's static. Whereas 2048, a new number shows up randomly in some random square.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be interesting to play with. But that's going to take a while because there's another algorithm I want to implement first. And that's enough of that nonsense. Why am I doing this? Because I'm disenchanted with neural networks.
I don't care about them. They're not doing what they're supposed to.
They're not doing what they're supposed to. They take forever. They take huge amounts of training data. And neural network design is basically trying to imitate the cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these nuclei around.
Right.
Yes, and a lot of them could implement algorithms similar to the things I'm playing with now.
Cool.
So, the other end of AI, as I like to call it.
Yeah, I had a professor made the point that maybe 10% of your time setting up a neural network is spent on coding, and the rest of it is spent on training.
Including the, why did you learn the wrong thing?
Who's been teaching you this?
Yes, I was not looking for, I'm still not, because I'm going to play with them sooner or later. I'm not looking forward to wondering whether or not it's a bug in my code or something wrong with the training data.
Mm-hmm.
Total mystery.
Well, what are you going to do?
What are we going to do? Take a nap?
Talk about something completely different.
Yeah, so I took a nap, only while I was falling asleep, suddenly I felt like I was falling.
And then, wah-wah!
Yeah.
Which is my...
You brought up the wah-wah last time, and I did a little poking around. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows.
Okay. Here we are again.
From what I read, your body may physically jerk several times within a night. Bend of the arm, kick of the leg, flex of the hips, or tightening of the stomach muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times when this happens, you never notice.
Oh, okay. It
fails to wake you. But there's a specific set of circumstances. And I have decades worth of investigating dreams and lucid dreams and various forms of meditation. Just reams and reams and volumes of crap I wrote about it. But I had actually gotten interested in this particular sleep start.
Mm.
What I noticed is that sometimes you will have a jerk and be woken awake. Woken awake? Woken.
Sure.
But there is no accompanying sense of falling.
Oh, okay.
Other times, you definitely feel like you're falling first and then jerk. I suspect different mechanisms. I'm gonna conjecture, because nobody knows, so I might as well.
Yeah.
What I noticed about the ones specifically where I feel like I'm falling is that usually I am in some dream image, like walking down a sidewalk. Then my feet come down, find no sidewalk, and then I panic.
Okay.
What I think is happening is that as you are drifting to sleep, some of the mechanisms involved in sleep don't quite come online quite yet like they should.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So when your mind reaches for some sensory information, either from your feet or maybe your vestigial system, your balance system, and it gets the wrong information, it feels like you're falling and you panic. And there is a structure in your brain called the reticular activating system.
Okay, fun.
Lots to do with the sleep-wake cycle, lots of different nuclei in that area. Now, one in particular, the locus coeruleus.
Sounds like a flower.
Does it? Yeah, it kind of does. Yeah. Yeah. This little guy sends neural epinephrine to your brain or down your spinal cord. Adrenaline.
Oh, okay.
It's not the only source of adrenaline. It can be dumped directly into your bloodstream by the adrenal gland down there by your kidneys. But this is the little center in your brain. And the adrenaline isn't all for the vaunted fight or flight response. You need that neural adrenaline or neural epinephrine for your brain to tick over like it's supposed to. But in REM sleep, in particular, this little nucleus, is almost entirely inactive.
Okay.
So I suspect what happens is it stops wanting to send out its neural transmitter. And as a result, it builds up within that nuclei.
Okay. Okay.
And then you get some sensation that doesn't feel quite right and feel slightly concerned.
Okay.
Which is just enough to activate it and cause it to flood forth with way more of that stuff than you need right now.
Something's weird.
Cool. Yeah. That is in line with one whole set of theories about this phenomenon, which is basically that the wrong circuits turn off or don't turn off, and crossed wires end up causing you to feel like you're falling, and the body jerks.
Yeah, okay.
It's an interesting little center. It's blue.
Is it? Why?
It's pigmented.
For reasons.
For reasons.
Wasn't there then the substantia nigra?
Exactly. Right? I'm so glad you asked that question. That is generally dark as opposed to blue. Neural melanin, as opposed to the regular melanin you have in the rest of your body. Mm-hmm. It's a pigment. And it builds up in the substantia nigra over time.
So when you're tiny? When you're...
I don't know if you ever have a point in your life where there's no pigment there, but it increases over your lifespan.
Hmm.
Now, why is it there? Well,
I don't know. What you tell me.
Apparently, it protects the neurons.
Huh.
I don't know why they specifically mentioned oxidative stress. I don't know why that would be more prevalent in the midbrain than any other part of the brain. But there's a disease called Parkinson's disease.
All right. Right.
One of the things it does is removes the melanin from different neurons within your brain. That includes the locus coeruleus and the substantia nigra.
Ah.
And then these neurons start to die.
Weird.
Yes, and nobody really knows what kills neurons in Parkinson's disease. The fact that the melanin goes away and then the neurons start to die might be a coincidence. One might not actually have anything to do with the other, but that's what happens.
I keep thinking, you know, we're not exactly... our brain is not exposed to sunlight.
No, it is not.
This is the only other protective thing I can think of for melanin, but I guess it's more interesting than I thought it was.
And this episode actually is about the substantia nigra in particular, which has two parts. Now, you can't see that just by eyeballing it. They had to do a lot of careful studying. You've got the substantia nigra pars compacta.
Okay.
And the substantia nigra pars reticulata.
I imagine the compacta is dense.
Yes!
Go figure.
You're so smart! The pars reticulata, which is the less dense bit, seems to be functionally about the same as the globus pallidus. Right. By default, it's on and sending inhibitory output towards the thalamus.
Ah.
It's separated from the globus pallidus by what they call the internal capsule.
Yes, it is.
What is that? It's a big fat bundle of fibers. That's what that is. And there's a couple of places, like in the striatum, you've got the putamen. Mm-hmm. And then the internal capsule comes along to separate the putamen from the caudate nucleus. And again, it looks like functionally, they're pretty much the same region. But if you eyeball it, it looks like two different places.
You keep saying eyeball it. I mean, you have to open a person's head to eyeball something.
Well, yes.
Or do you mean throw eyeballs at it?
Well, that too. Depends upon which party you're at.
Oh, goodness.
The neurons in the pars reticulata are GABAergic. They send out GABA, which is an inhibitory neural transmitter.
Cool.
And the pars reticulata can actually encourage or discourage movement, depending upon what kind of inputs it's getting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm going to say about that, because I don't understand it.
I agree. You don't understand anything. No,
it's getting some conflicting results too. One says it's nothing but an extension of the globus pallidus. Another says it's the major output for the basal ganglia.
They don't know. Wow.
Then we've got the pars compacta.
Ah, okay.
Denser area, more neurons per cubic what have you.
Uh-huh.
And these are where the neurons that have dopamine in them start out.
Dopamine.
Sending their output mostly to the striatum. Well, mostly. One of the places they send the output to is the striatum. When dopamine is received, it encourages the direct pathway and discourages the indirect pathway. Hit the gas, take off the brakes.
Ready, set, go.
Now, this is the brain.
Right.
And I was wondering, you know, you get this subjective feel that you can stop.
Right.
Put on the brakes. And mechanically, does that mean that we just take off our intent to move? Is that enough to shut down? Or is there another system there? Because it's evolution. It could go either way.
Well, I mean, okay, intent to stop. You're walking, right?
Right.
When you stop, it's a lot more complicated than just everything shutting down. Because otherwise you just flop to the floor.
I was specifically thinking about when you freeze in an emergency situation.
Oh.
Like you're reaching for something when you're a kid that's about to burn your hand and your mom yells no.
Uh-huh.
And you stop.
In that voice. One voice.
The mommy voice, yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing, but I need to stop.
Turns out that acetylcholine that's coming from some of the neurons within the striatum will discourage the direct pathway and encourage the indirect one.
Mm-hmm.
Foot off the gas and on the brake.
Oh, so it's an active...
Yeah, so you've got one that wants to make you move and one that wants to make you stop. And they push and pull against each other.
Why is life so complicated? I mean,
life. It's you. You're the complicated one. So, looking at this neuromelanin thing,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that it builds up over the course of your lifetime, it took me forever to confirm that particular factoid, by the way.
It is hard to find things sometimes.
Anyway. Yeah, you get a lot of things. This is a disadvantage to being self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these articles assume you know. Because everybody knows that, right?
You're trying to find the more complicated bits, so you jump into the deep end of the...
and you're missing some details. Part of the reason I'm doing this show is to fill the vast gaping holes in my knowledge base. But I kind of wondered about our sense of time.
Oh.
Now, here is this... change that happens to this group of cells over the course of your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if that has anything to do with how long ago things feel. Maybe if a memory is laid down when there's not much pigment,
mm-hmm.
compared to how much pigment you have now, it seems further back. Some sort of mysterious encoding of the amount of pigment that was there.
Interesting.
So I dug around, and it turns out that the substantia nigra, or at least the basal ganglia, are implicated in our subjective sense of time.
Cool.
Right, except it doesn't hold together. I could cherry pick and just put up that one article and say, see, I was right.
Yeah.
It turns out there are a whole bunch of different systems that estimate time. And the basal ganglia are implicated in time estimations of a split second to several seconds to maybe a couple of minutes long.
Okay.
Right. Which is the wrong time scale I was thinking of. I was thinking days, weeks, months, right?
Right,
maybe
right.
Even years. When you try and remember that sort of thing, you usually get activity in the prefrontal cortex. And then a whole bunch of other places as you access memories and try to use your autobiographical tale to figure out how long ago something happened.
Interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
And you can't exactly put somebody in a box for years and years, so
well,
that'll be harder to study with a light.
Other than me. I'm in a box right now.
Yeah.
But that is a closer look at the substantia nigra, as well as covering some of the things that came up in the last episode. I think for the next one, we're going to take a closer look at that reticular formation. It's a very old part of the brain.
Oh, neat.
So we'll do that next time. See you then.
Bye.